Thank you, Christian. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for this opportunity to come to this conference and also to thank Eric. Listening to Carlos's talk was a bit humbling. I realized that my entire career has basically been marginal commentary on the work of Eric Sawyer. But since I also learned from Christian that this was in honor of your birthday, I decided to bake you a cake. So happy birthday, Eric. Because you're number one. All right. Oh, well, it's a virtual cake, so I guess that's a pretty easy parameter to reset. Okay, so I want to talk about the maximal operator, something near and dear to my heart, and I want to conclude with weighted Norman equalities for the maximal operator, but I want to do it on a different kind of space. So I want to move away from the Lebesgue spaces to what are called the variable Lebesgue spaces. These spaces have been of great interest for the past 20 years. They were actually introduced by Ehrlich back in the 1930s, sort of fell out of view, came back in for their applications in PDEs and particularly in fluid dynamics. I won't talk about that because I don't know anything about that. I'll just talk about the spaces. So what is a variable Lebesgue? Oh, I should also say this is joint work, particularly with my co-authors Alberto Fiorenza and Christoph Neugebauer, and then also with Chema Martel and Carlos Perez. Their names will appear in the names of some other people in Europe, will show up from time to time. So what is a variable Lebesgue space? Well, the basic idea is that Lebesgue spaces is you raise a function to the power p, okay, where p is fixed. Well, what we're going to do is we want to change that so that p varies with your location in your domain. I'll write here generally omega. You can think of omega as all of Rn. So an exponent function is just some function which maps omega to the set 1 and infinity. Okay, and we're going to include infinity as a possible value for the exponent p. So somehow, as you move around in the space, here you're in L2, here you're in L3, over here you're in L infinity. Okay, so just a little bit of notation. We have to consider the exceptional set where p is equal to infinity. We have to treat that part of the space a little differently. And some notation, how the function p varies. Its essential infimum and essential supremum are just going to always use this subscript minus or plus, and then we'll just throw away what the domain is. So if I write simply p minus, I mean its infimum over the whole domain. If I write p plus, I mean its supremum over the whole domain. And again, in full generality, p minus could be 1 and p plus could be equal to infinity. Okay. So to define this kind of space, ideally you'd want to think like a Lebesgue space. You would just take this quantity right here, and the variable Lebesgue space would be all the places where that integral quantity is finite. Okay? Well, we have to worry about infinity, so we peel off the place where the exponent's infinite, and we just stick in the L infinity norm there. This isn't a norm, and this isn't an adequate enough definition, because you can have functions for which this quantity is infinite, but if you stick a small constant in on f, it becomes finite. Okay? That only happens when p is unbounded, but p unbounded is often the most interesting case. So what we do is we introduce a Luxembourg norm. This should look familiar in form if you work with Ehrlich spaces. This is how you define an Ehrlich norm. So rho is what we call the modular, and so you just look for all the functions f such that for some value of lambda the modular is finite, and then the norm is given by you take the infimum over all those lambdas such that that modular is less than or equal to 1. And with that, you get a norm, and LP Punto, as I refer to it, is a Banach function space. So it has all the kinds of properties, say, that Bennett and Sharpley described for Banach function spaces and the relationship to the norm. And it's a nice space, and it looks a lot like the classical Lebesgue space. But I think the best way to describe the differences without getting into technicalities is through this picture, with apologies to Lewis Carroll. So if you know your Lewis Carroll, this is one of the original Tennille illustrations. And Alice has been invited to a tea party hosted by the Red Queen. And at a tea party in Victorian England, you often played croquet. So she felt that going into this, she knew what was going to happen. Except the problem was in the Red Queen's garden party, you weren't given a mallet, you were given a flamingo. And you weren't given a ball, you were given a hedgehog who would often roll up into a ball. And so the problem for Alice was is that every time she got the ball under control and made it stay in one place and not wander off into the woods, the flamingo wouldn't cooperate. And every time she got the flamingo to cooperate, the ball would have gotten up and walked away. And so I would say that this is what a variable Lebesgue space is like. You think going in, you know what's going on. You think you are in something that looks very much like a Lebesgue space. But every time you get the ball under control, the flamingo runs away or something. The idea is you know what ought to be true, because going into this, if P plus is bounded, so if you're in the case where you have bounded exponent functions, then these spaces really do look like the variable Lebesgue spaces. There are bounded functions of compact support are dense, you have nice duality theorems, there's a dominated convergence theorem. But then things go really awry. So for example, there are no mollifiers. You can construct cases where mollifiers won't converge to the original function. Okay? And that's actually what led to the interest in led to the interest in these spaces. In PDEs, they wanted to introduce Sobolev space theory. So what's a common technique in Sobolev spaces? You want to approximate by smooth functions. So you just convolve with a smooth mollifier, let epsilon go to zero. Well, you can construct very simple examples where those mollifiers don't converge. Okay, so then a pressing question became, what kinds of assumptions do we have to put on the exponent functions to let us rebuild some basic Sobolev space theory? And dealing with mollifiers, that led very naturally to the question of the maximal operator, which is what I'd like to talk about. Okay, so let's start with some simple examples just to show you how things can go wrong for the maximal operator. So let's take the simplest exponent function you can think of, p is equal to 2, to the left of the origin, and 3 to the right. Okay? Well, the maximal function is bounded on L2, it's bounded on L3, it fails to be bounded on this variable Lebesgue space. And the counterexample is really simple, and will also suggest to you why mollifiers go awry. We'll just take a function which exists only on the left, so it's x to the minus 1/3 to the left of the origin. Okay? Well, that's where it's equal to L2, so this function is in this particular variable Lebesgue space. But if you take x to the right and take averages which extend across the origin in the obvious way, you basically get back the same function, okay? X to the minus 1/3. I think that constant 3 is wrong, but that probably doesn't matter. Okay, but the point is now you have something x to the minus 1/3 on the other side of the origin where you're L3. So it's no longer integrable. It's not in the variable Lebesgue space. So somehow, a simple discontinuity ruins everything. So the question comes up then is, do we actually need P continuous? And if so, what kind of regularity should we have? So we'll just modify this example. It's 2 here. It's 3 out here. How quickly does it have to come down to the origin to prevent this phenomenon from happening? Okay, and it's actually a good exercise with the actual example I just gave to try and play with it and see what it tells you about this function phi. Okay, now let's move away from local behavior. Let's talk about what happens at infinity. So let's say, and we'll show that if P is locally smooth, that's what you need. So let's take a really smooth function which oscillates at infinity. So we'll let p be, say, 3 plus the sine function. So it oscillates nicely between 2 and 4. Okay. Well, we're going to do the same thing, and this example is easiestly understood with the following picture. So blue is the exponent function. Below that, in green, is our function f of x, which is basically x to the minus 1/3 going out to infinity, but I'm only defining the function near where the exponent function is 4. So again, everything's perfectly nice out at infinity, so that function's in LP punto. But the maximal function is roughly, again, because the gaps between the support of the function are small, you can bound the function below by this red line, which is roughly x to the minus 1/3. And so now that lives where the exponent function is close to 2, and again, you fall out of this variable Lebesgue space. So even though our exponent function is really, really nice locally, oscillatory behavior gets you in trouble at infinity. So you have to ask, what has to happen at infinity? Does it have to be continuous at infinity, i.e., does it have to approach some limit at infinity? And do we need some kind of regularity at that point? So these are the questions which were being asked when I got interested in this problem. And then I threw in a couple more to the mix. So first of all, we all know that the maximal operator is bounded on L infinity. Okay. So can we take a variable Lebesgue exponent, which is equal to infinity in some of its domain and not in other parts of the domain? So somehow can you have a function which is just an LP very, very close to a place where the exponent is actually infinite and somehow survive that transition? Okay. And then the other question was, is we know that the maximal function is not bounded on L1. But suppose we took an exponent function which most places is very, very far away from 1 and then comes sneaking down a little cusp. So just at one point, it may never be equal to 1, but it just gets arbitrarily close to 1. Can we make that cusp so narrow, put it on the boundary, get it away from where most of the function lives, and still preserve the boundedness of the maximal operator? Okay. Well, let me try and answer some of these questions. So the first thing is, let's talk about some sufficient conditions which address these questions about regularity of the exponent. When this problem was first being investigated, again, from the perspective of Sobolev space theory, a lot of people were assuming that the exponent function was C1 or satisfied some sort of Holder continuity exponent. The right condition was introduced by a Russian named Zhikov back in the 80s and then picked up again by Lars Diening and his advisor Ruzicka in the 90s. And the idea is you need some kind of continuity, but really you need what we call log Holder continuity. So you have to decay like 1 over the logarithm of the distance between x and y. And we write it in this kind of funny way like this because we allow p to be unbounded. So what would it mean for an unbounded function to be log Holder continuous? Well, you take inverses, you got a function which lives in 0 to 1. So continuity makes sense. So we say that the function is in the LH0 class, locally log Holder continuous, if its inverse it satisfies this condition. And then clearly if p plus is bounded, then we can just assume that the function p itself has log Holder continuity. And the nice thing is this property is preserved under taking duality. And I didn't define it, but you can define the dual space or the dual exponent pointwise using the same formula you use in the Lebesgue spaces, and as long as P is bounded, then this formula lets you define the dual space. Okay? And again, just to show you how things can get interesting, this identity is true if and only if the exponent function is bounded. And it's unbounded, things go radically, radically wrong. Okay. So again, log Holder continuity is preserved when you pass to the dual exponent. Well, we wanted to say something at infinity. And again, this example of oscillatory behavior at infinity suggested we needed control. So we introduced a limit, call it P infinity. And then again, we want it to be log Holder continuous at infinity, meaning it decays uniformly to this value, p of x, and again, controlled just by a logarithm. Okay, so with these two continuity conditions, again, p plus is less than infinity, you can just worry about the function p itself, and I'm going to put the two together and just call that log Holder, LH, from now on. Okay, so here's the big theorem, due to myself, Alberto Fiorenza, Christoph Neugebauer. This theorem has gone now through like 3 or 4 different proofs. It's still an extremely difficult, or at least I'd say very technical result to prove. So what can we say? Let's P be some exponent function, and let's assume that 1 over P is log Holder continuous. Then you get a weak type norm inequality. So we write our weak type inequalities in this fashion because it has to involve the norm on the left-hand side. Okay. More importantly, if you assume that P minus is strictly bigger than 1, so again, going back to this question of can you let P minus be equal to 1, then you get the boundedness of the maximal function. Okay. So I want to talk about the proof. As I said, the proof is very technical, but I just want to give you some flavor of the kinds of things that you have to worry about. Okay. So first you make some reductions. The first ones are sort of standard in Lebesgue theory. You can assume that f is non-negative because these are maximal functions. It's bounded in compact support. You just do an approximation argument. When you're dealing with a variable Lebesgue space, however, you also have to take advantage of homogeneity and assume that the function has norm 1. And the reason for this is you want to get away from the norm and pass to, because you can't do anything with the norm. So this is ugly. So the kinds of things you want to work with are these integrals right here. But if P is unbounded, you need this integral to be finite, okay, which requires you to assume that the norm is less than or equal to 1. Okay, and these are the kinds of things that you actually want to estimate. So the whole proof boils down to is by some arguments involving the norm. If this is less than or equal to 1, if you put the maximal function here, if you can show that this modular quantity is bounded by some constant depending on the dimension and on P and et cetera, then you get actually the norm inequality will follow from that. Okay. So that's fairly technical, but really only this is where some of the properties of the space come in. Now, usually, again, in the classical Lebesgue spaces, you just deal with the function. You take the function and you do things with it, particularly for the maximal operator. Here, that doesn't work. You have to split the function into pieces and consider the places where it's large and the places where it's small separately. Okay? And what that really boils down to is you're using different conditions locally where the function is big and where the function is small, and you can think of that as being out at infinity. Okay. For both pieces, you then apply a Calderon-Zygmund decomposition. But the argument looks more like, say, the beginning of Eric's proof, for example, of the boundedness of the maximal function. You take this apart, split it up into various levels, form the Calderon-Zygmund cubes at those levels. And then this is where the log-Holder continuity conditions come in. Where f is large, you only use the log-Holder continuity condition. So if you're trying to prove this theorem on a bounded domain, the only thing you need is local log-Holder continuity. And then where f is small, you need some kind of control as you move out to infinity, and that's where log-Holder continuity at infinity comes in. And then in both cases, you reassemble the pieces in such a way that where f is large, you use the fact that the maximal operator is just bounded on LP minus. And then where f is small, you reassemble it and use the fact that the maximal operator is bounded on LP infinity. So in other words, at the heart of the proof is the classical result. You have to reduce it to a classical result on a regular Lebesgue space. Okay. So I'm not going to go into the technical details. I could for the rest of the lecture devote to just sorting out this proof, but instead I want to talk about some of the things that can come from this. So one of the nicest things that comes right away, and this is the biggest application of this theorem, is extrapolation in the variable Lebesgue spaces. Okay, so this is joint with myself, Alberto, Chema, and Carlos. So a couple different ways to state this. This is probably the simplest. Given some operator T, and we make essentially no assumptions about the operator, except that it satisfies some kind of weighted norm inequality on some weighted space. There just has to be some exponent P naught. We have a weighted norm inequality like this, and all we assume on the weight is A1. So we put the strongest possible weight condition on the weights. So for example, if we're dealing with singular integral operators, Calderon-Zygmund-Sigler integral operators. This inequality holds for any p naught bigger than 1 and w actually in AP and not A1. Okay? You can say similar things about convolution operators. There's off-diagonal versions of this which let you talk about fractional integral operators. Here's the simplest case right here. So all we assume is some nice weighted norm inequality. And then if you take any exponent function p naught such that p minus is bigger than this threshold p naught, okay, and you assume it's log Holder continuous. But really the only reason you're doing that, assuming log Holder continuity, and this will be important coming up, is you need that the maximal operator is bounded on a certain variable Lebesgue space. Not exactly the dual space, you have to drop down a little bit to deal with the exponent p naught. And then what do you get? You get that this operator is bounded on this Banach function space. Okay. So let me stress what I think is really important about this, is it takes going, and this we've generalized this theorem since then that you can put not just the variable Lebesgue spaces, but any kind of Banach function space, whether or not it's a rearrangement invariant. And let me stress that variable Lebesgue spaces are not rearrangement invariant. Okay. So as long as you have weighted norm inequalities in the classical Lebesgue spaces, and you can prove something about the boundedness of the maximal operator on the dual spaces of the Banach function spaces that you're interested in, then you can prove that the classical operators of harmonic analysis are all bounded on these Banach function spaces. So in one fell swoop with this theorem, what did we prove? We proved singular integral operators, fractional integral operators, convolution operators, multipliers that satisfy nice conditions. All of those are now bounded on the variable Lebesgue spaces. Okay. So as one of my colleagues, Lars Diening, said, we sort of took the wind out of their sails because a lot of effort up until this point had been going one operator at a time. We got the maximal operator. Well, then let's prove something for the Sharpe maximal operator. Then let's prove something for the Hilbert transform. All sorts of different kinds of proofs are now captured by this. And again, really emphasizing the importance of understanding the maximal operator on these spaces. So really the Calderon-Zygmund philosophy coming to the fore. Okay, so at this point it looked like we were done, or if not done, then we were in a very, very happy place. But let's go back to those regularity questions I was asking. Okay? Because here we're assuming a fairly good amount of regularity on our exponent function, log Holder continuity. And notice buried in this theory is we don't need this. So for extrapolation and for all these operators to be bounded, we don't need the log Holder continuity. We just need that the maximal operator is bounded. So this is, provides good impetus for asking the question, can we relax these conditions in any way? And the answer is we can, but we have absolutely no idea how, because everything seems to go awry. So let's start with something simple. The simplest one of all, the one I was most hopeful for, you can't do. So you have to have p minus bounded away from 1. And we constructed an example, and actually I should include Lars Diening in here, who cleaned up some technical problems in the original proof, that if this infimum of the exponent function is 1, and this infimum can occur locally or it can occur out at infinity, doesn't matter, the maximal operator can't be bounded. And roughly, here's what you can do. If p minus equals 1, then you can find a bunch of balls, and exponents sk going downwards to 1, such that on these balls, p of x is small, somewhere between 1 and this value. And then you can construct a function like this. It's very close to the critical exponent, minus n plus 1 over k plus 1. You can choose the sk's so that this thing is still in your Lebesgue space. But when you go ahead and estimate the maximal operator, again, by careful choice of these exponents, the maximal operator is bigger than the function by a constant which is roughly k plus 1. And so that shows that you simply can't have the maximal operator bounded on this space. So I was really disappointed, because I really thought that this would be the one kind of big difference between variable Lebesgue spaces and the classical case, that we could get down to 1, and we can. But what else was shown? This is an example in the local case due to Pick and Ruzicka and myself and Chris and Alberto in at the boundary. The local log holder log holder continuity, both locally and at infinity, is in some sense pointwise sharp. It's the absolute best that you can do. So what I mean by this is, take some other function which goes to zero, which grows just a little bit more quickly than the logarithm, or decays a little more quickly than the logarithm. I think there might be a... No, that's right. That's right. Okay. All right. So then what are we going to do? We're going to define a new exponent function which is 2 to the left of the origin, and it's 2 plus this function phi. Okay? So what this condition tells you is it's not log holder continuous. It doesn't decay like 1 over the log as you move towards the origin. But you can take phi to be really, really close to that. So in particular, it could be any power of a logarithm. So it could go like any power of 1 over the log. Okay? Well, it's not log holder continuous, and the maximal operator is not bounded. Okay? So somehow this makes this the right condition. Okay? But lurking in this is the real problem, the asymmetry in this exponent function, that it's coming down quickly just from one side, is crucial to the counterexample. Okay? And as we'll see in a minute, if you make it symmetric, then the example no longer works. And a similar construction holds at infinity. Okay? So these are pointwise sharp, or as we used to say, they're almost necessary. Okay, but here's the problem. If you take away that asymmetry in the construction, it doesn't work. And so if you take an exponent function that looks like this, it's the same on both sides, decay is like 1 over the square root of the logarithm to the origin, then the maximal function is bounded on this space. Okay, and there's nothing particularly special. I know how to do it for logarithms or fractional powers of the logarithm, so there's nothing special about that 1/2. Okay, and I really don't know what else you can put in there. So that's really an open question, is what is exactly the behavior you can have at the origin when you allow this symmetry at this point. And I imagine you can do similar things in higher dimensions, but we've only looked at these on the real line. And then you can play with this example at infinity and get the same sort of thing. If it decays like 1 over the square root of the logarithm uniformly in all directions, has a real forced symmetry at the origin, then again, the maximal operator is bounded. So somehow, even though these are the right conditions, and they show up in applications very naturally, they're not the right conditions for the maximal operator. Okay. And the following example, due to Lerner, makes it even worse. You don't even need continuity at the origin. Okay. You can't have a step discontinuity. It can't be a jump. But let's let it oscillate. So it's going to be basically 2 plus the sine of the log of 1 over x. And if you draw that picture, you'll see that it oscillates, but oscillates in some sense very, very slowly as you move towards the origin. And as long as that constant alpha is small enough, then the maximal operator is bounded there at the origin. And if you reverse this property and basically say, as you go to infinity, you have log of x, the same thing happens. The maximal operator will be bounded, even though you've thrown away all of this continuity. The proof of this exploits a connection between weighted norm inequalities and the variable Lebesgue spaces, which I think is really not well understood. And this is really a theorem about multipliers of BMO. Okay, so the construction does not fit into what I would call the theoretical framework of variable Lebesgue spaces. It's coming at it sort of obliquely from another direction. And again, what is going on here? What is the role of the continuity in the exponent? Is there some way to express the continuity in an average sense? And most attempts to try and do that have failed to date. No one seems to be able to write down what average continuity means in any meaningful way to get a general theory to prove that the maximal operator is bounded. So that's a big open question in this area. Okay, there is a necessary and sufficient condition due to Lars-Dehning, which is both incredibly important and incredibly useless. So let me, and I've said that to Lars, and he sometimes agrees with me, sometimes he doesn't. But it is a really important result, and I really like it. So let's let script Y just be the collections of script Q, where script Q will just mean pairwise disjoint cubes. Okay, we want to look at all possible collections of pairwise disjoint cubes. And given any collection of disjoint cubes, we'll define this averaging operator A script Q, where you let F be equal to its average on one of these cubes and zero outside of it. So if the cubes are actually cover the whole space, you're replacing F by its averages. Now you can think of this as, for example, averages on the dyadic grid or some other thing. But key thing, the cubes do not have to be uniform in size. They just have to be disjoint. As a matter of fact, you can't restrict this theorem to uniform grids. You have to take all possible grids of cubes. And then he proved the following. And this, again, is in the case when P plus is bounded, but that's mostly a technical detail here. So the following are equivalent. The maximal operator is bounded, which is what we want. All of these averaging operators are uniformly bounded. Okay, but then also, the maximal operator is bounded on the dual space. And you can write it this way. We replace the maximal operator with a slightly bigger operator where you raise it to a power s and then take 1 over s. This maximal operator is bounded on LP. Another way of saying this is saying that the maximal operator is bounded when you drop down a little bit in the scale of spaces. Okay, and if you go back to the statement of the extrapolation theorem, this theorem captures all the fundamental hypotheses that you need. So if you assume that M is bounded on LP, then it's bounded on P divided by some small quantity, which there I called P naught, and then it's bounded on the dual space. So it'd be bounded on P punto divided by P naught prime. So that's exactly the hypotheses you need for extrapolation. So that's why, theoretically, this is a really, really important result. The problem with it is that you simply cannot check it. Because how would you check this? In the ordinary course of events, if I give you a collection of cubes and you want to check that the averaging operator on that family of cubes is bounded, what would you do? You'd replace it by the maximal operator. So as somebody once said, this theorem says that the maximal operator is bounded if and only if the maximal operator is bounded. Okay, but that's not true. That's not true. And one of the reasons is these AQs are linear operators. And it's that linearity which immediately lets you pass to the boundedness of the maximal operator on the dual space. Okay, and indeed that leads to what I think is a big open question in this area. Find a direct proof of this, that if you assume that M is bounded on the variable Lebesgue space, then it's bounded on the dual space. Okay, again, Lars's proof you have to pass through these averaging operators, and invoking the averaging operators brings with it a lot of extremely obscure and deep technical machinery. Okay? And here's the baby problem, which I keep going around and asking people, and everybody laughs at me for asking it. Do this in the classical Lebesgue space case, okay? By which I mean simply take as basically your only hypothesis that the maximal operator is bounded on LP, then without using anything else, really, prove it's bounded on LP prime. Okay? Because if you think about it, how do we prove boundedness on the classical spaces? We somehow get all the spaces at once. We have to pass through a weak type inequality, and we have to use Marcinkiewicz interpolation. These spaces are not rearrangement invariant. There is, as yet, no theory of interpolation corresponding to Marcinkiewicz interpolation. I brought this up with a bunch of people who do interpolation theory and asked if we could come up with some version of real interpolation for these spaces, and they all started laughing at me. Not because they thought it was a stupid question, but just because it looked so intractable to try and do something like that in a space which is not a rearrangement invariant. Okay. So if you could do this, even in the classical Lebesgue space, if you can give me a proof in the classical Lebesgue space, that will give me something to go on. And I think it would be a very important result that would come out of that. Okay, so I want to finish now by talking about the connection with AP weights and then come to a very recent result. As a matter of fact, I wasn't even sure I was going to finish the proof before the conference. I was going to lie, but now I don't have to lie. So I want to talk about weighted inequalities for the variable Lebesgue spaces. I'll define what that means. And then show that there's a connection, a very deep connection somehow with AP theory going on here. Okay, so let's start with what is actually a local condition for the boundedness of the maximal operator variable Lebesgue space. And so this is, I call it K0 after Coppoliani, who introduced it. It's sort of a balance condition. It says that if you take the characteristic function of a cube and LP, characteristic function of a cube in the dual space, then that's going to look roughly like the Lebesgue measure of the cube. You have a Holder's inequality, so this product right here is always within a constant bigger than or equal to the measure of the cube. This is saying it's also smaller. Okay? And if you sort of squint at that, you could almost say this looks like an AP-type condition. Okay, the weight is equal to 1, but remember now you have this variable exponent you have to worry about. So it's not obvious, and you can construct examples where this isn't true. But here's the theorem, Coppoliani, Lerner, Diening. If the maximal operator is bounded on LP, then the exponent P satisfies this AP-type condition. So it's a necessary condition. Okay? However, it's not quite sufficient. It's sufficient if you restrict yourself to a bounded domain, say a big cube or a big ball, and you satisfy the Coppoliani condition, then the maximal operator is bounded on this domain, but you pick up a constant which is roughly the measure of the domain. Okay. This is not just a technical obstruction. There exist examples both on the real line and in higher dimensions, such that you do satisfy this AP-type condition, but the maximal operator is not bounded. Okay? And this also points back to, in Diening's theorem, why he has to worry about these averaging operators on infinite families of cubes. If you write down a condition which somehow only depends on one cube, it doesn't work. Okay? It somehow fails to capture the variability at infinity. Okay. And again, when you think about the variability at infinity, always keep this example 2 plus the sine of the log of x in mind. Okay. So with this in mind, I wanted to talk about weighted norm inequalities. I wanted to introduce one-weight norm inequalities. I wanted a variable AP condition. So we defined it just by, let's stick a weight into this condition. So a weight W is an AP punto if exactly this. So I just took that previous condition and put a weight into it. Okay? And this is the AP condition with a slight variation. It's the same thing if P is a constant function, say not W, but W to the P is an AP. The reason for this is we're going to treat weights not as measures. So we're not going to have a measure W dx, but rather we're going to multiply the function by the weight and then put it into an unweighted space. That just proves to be easier in this space to treat weights as multipliers instead of as measures. When P is constant, that is sort of the natural way to do it. Particularly when you're looking at, say, fractional integral operators, then somehow you always write, for homogeneity purposes, you write the weights with a power. So you write U to the P on one side and V to the P on the other. Okay, so that just seems to be the right way to do it here. And so here's the theorem with a million names, and I don't want to go into the history of why it has all of these names attached to it. I just have to give, in particular, I have to give Lars Diening and Peter Hesto some credit for this result as well. And so let's let P be in a log holder continuous exponent. So I have to overcome a bunch of technical obstacles, so I have to go back and assume log holder continuity. But then I put this weight in the variable Lebesgue space, and I get this weighted norm inequality. Okay. I think I forgot the hypothesis that P minus has to be bigger than 1. Okay, that's floating around in there as well. Conversely, if the maximal operator satisfies this inequality with no assumptions on P, but just so long as it satisfies this inequality, then W has to be in this AP class. So in the presence of log holder continuity, this is a necessary and sufficient condition. And so then all of the questions which I raised before about relaxing these continuity conditions continue to show up here. Okay. What can we do to get rid of log holder continuity? Can we write down a condition which really only depends on the exponent P in some averaging sense and this weight W? Okay. So again, even here in this theorem, okay, what's the right replacement for Coppoliani's condition? Okay, this involves only one cube. You somehow lose information at infinity. Lars's condition is too much because it's unworkable in practice. It gives us some incredibly important information, but it's not a condition you can check. So is there a condition floating around that will put all of these things together, that will let us somehow weaken the weight condition? Dini and Hesto have actually conjectured in this case that if you replace the log holder continuity condition with the assumption that the maximal operator is bounded on the unweighted space. So again, throwing it back onto the maximal operator in the unweighted space. It's a great conjecture, but we have absolutely no evidence for it one way or the other. All right, I'd like to finish then, even though we can't really do anything, or there's still lots of unanswered questions in the one-weight case, I'd like to jump to the two-weight case. And following on Carlos, I want to show you another conjecture of Eric's that he didn't know about until just now. Oops, I had a slide in here about the proof, but I'm running short on time. So the proof is pretty much the same thing, but what it really boils down to is proving that in the presence of our hypotheses, these weights to powers actually lie in A infinity. Okay? And here you have to use log holder continuity, particularly log holder continuity in infinity, to get these kinds of estimates on the weight. And this is what lets you work in the modular case. And then after that, the proof follows pretty much the same ideas. You again have to split F up. You apply Calderon-Zygmund decomposition. You again use very strongly your log holder continuity conditions locally and at infinity. The one little change, which is why you need this up here, is because you have a weight. Well, if we pass down to P minus like we did in the original proof, then we'd have to have our weight in AP minus, and it's not going to be. Okay? So you have to replace the maximal operator by a weighted maximal operator. Here we're loosely following the proof of Kristen Pfefferman of the one-weight norm inequality, where they do that nice decomposition and then introduce this weighted norm inequality. Okay, so that's that. Sorry about that. So back to my original final point is what happens in the two-weight case? Well, it seems natural to conjecture that you might have a testing condition. So we have a pair of weights, U and V. We want some kind of condition necessary and sufficient for that norm inequality to hold. Okay, it's going to depend on the weights, and it's going to depend on the exponent and some interplay between them. So here's the conjecture. It's the testing condition. As written, it looks a little strange because that comes from the way that we wrote down the original inequality. But roughly speaking, we're testing it on characteristic functions of cubes. Now, I really dithered in making this conjecture whether I should make this term here on the left only be the integral over the cube itself. Okay, because then that would be, if you made it p constant, Eric's testing condition for the maximal operator. Okay, but again, I'm really worried about any kind of condition that will capture the behavior at infinity. Okay, and I really suspect that if you restrict yourself just to a cube inside an integral, you're throwing away too much information about the exponent function at infinity, and that you really need to let that integral go all the way out. I'd be delighted to be proved wrong about this, but that's my conjecture. There are some very tentative partial results from two Georgian mathematicians, Vakhtang Kokilashvili and Meshki. I'm not going to go into them because they're only on the real line, and they require much stronger assumptions than even log Holder continuity to make things happen. But they at least suggest that this is going in the right direction. Beyond that, I don't know. And I'm out of time, and this is a very good place to stop. Thank you again.